This is episode 28. Today is April 7th, 2016. I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, coming to you from Queens, New York, and I'm on the line with the Warnerd himself, Gary Brecher, a.k.a. John Dolan, in Turin. John, are you there?
I'm here, right here in Turin.
All right, and how's the hay fever, by the way?
It's fine if you don't go outdoors.
I see. So you haven't been going outdoors much then?
No, but there's a lot happening. I mean, you can actually start to live online when you live in as much isolation as we do. I mean, we know a few people here, but not very many. And going out consists of a fun but kind of alienating trip to the supermarket every now and then.
Mm. How's your Italian, by the way?
Yeah, well, Catherine's Italian is very good.
Uh-huh.
My Italian, I guess I'm slowly learning to read, but I have, you know, I have this bizarre irritation almost at Italian spelling because, you know, I learned more or less in quotes Spanish in school and then studied a lot of other languages later, some of them Romance languages, and I can handle all those spelling systems, but Italian tends to do something I can't handle, which is substitute an I for an L. Like, I can understand that in Spanish, a square is plaza. In French, it's place. But piazza, no. I mean, it's you can't substitute an I for an L.
It's a beheaded L.
That's actually a good idea. That might short-circuit my aversion.
I don't want to waste too much time before we get to this amazing interview, and you lined it up with Gunnar Jonsson of Icelandic Public Radio. So what we want to do is get to the interviews as quickly as possible, and then you and I can talk about some other things afterwards. But first of all, just tell us how you got in touch with him or how he got in touch with you.
Gunnar very kindly got in touch with me via Facebook through the Gary Brecher Facebook page. And he was nice enough to say that he'd read some of my articles and he found that they gave him a pretty good sense of what was going on in the Middle East. And he had a particular interest in the Middle East because, as you'll hear, there's some family background there. And also because, and he told me this in a very modest way, he'd been in online contact with some actual serving members of Islamic State jihadis, for a considerable time. And he told me that very matter-of-factly and sent me a link to an interview where he talked about it. And I was completely astonished. I mean, this is amazing. As you'll hear in the interview, we followed the same Twitter accounts for a while when it was easier for jihadis to get Twitter accounts. But I never even thought of contacting the people behind those accounts. I thought they'd refuse in the first place, and I don't have the mental discipline to talk to people like that at great length either. But Gunnar did. He actually got in touch with them, and he's maintained long-term contact with these guys who put up the beheading videos. It's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. And we were lucky enough to get his cooperation for an interview, even though he'd just been talking to the BBC, because just when we wanted to interview him, Iceland became the center of the news world because the prime minister resigned.
Right, because of the Panama Papers. The first victim of the Panama Papers was the prime minister of Iceland who resigned. And so, yeah, so Gunnar sort of juggling that story. But in any event, he took about an hour out to talk with us about a bit about that and then mostly about his online communications and relationship with Islamic State fighters. And one of the things that stands out to me is that how much it confirms a lot of what you've been writing, you know, deductively, like figuring it out. So anyway, let's get on to the interview right now with Gunnar Jonsson.
White line fever, a sickness born down deep within my soul.
Okay, so right now we are joined by a special guest, and I hope I pronounce this right again. He just told me, Gunnar Jolson. He's a he's at the foreign desk at Iceland Public Radio RUV. And Gunnar, can you hear us?
Yes, yes, I can.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us on Radio Warnerd.
Yes, thanks very much. I know it's been a busy time, and it can't be easy to take time out to discuss a slower story like this.
It's actually pretty comforting to just, you know, focus on ISIS and not this horror that's going on right here.
Yeah, we just saw you on BBC. Are you getting getting swamped by people looking for somebody to talk with, or?
Yeah, especially today, because, you know, nobody understands what's going on. We've had headlines in Norwegian media and other media just saying nobody in Iceland understands what's going on, and nobody understands what's going on in Iceland.
Huh. So, I mean, it happened so fast.
Yeah, it did.
Why did it affect, of all the politicians in the world, the Icelandic prime minister, you know, so quickly? Why did he resign so quickly as opposed to perhaps some other place? I mean, we know why Putin didn't resign, but anyway.
Yeah. Well, it was just so particularly galling in this case because he was elected on promises to rein in the old banks and he talked a lot about foreign investors in hedge funds in tax havens being like carrion trying to pick apart the corpse of the Icelandic banks. And you know, then it turns out that he was involved in a company that was registered in the same place, and also he was confronted in an interview where he didn't know he was going to be asked about it, and he walked out.
Right.
I saw that interview. That was a bad look.
Yes.
I don't know much about deflecting tactics, but there has to be something better than unclipping the microphone and running away.
Exactly. He has apologized for that part. That's the only part he's apologized for. He apologized for giving a poor interview. So that's something.
Well, it's honest in a way, I guess. That's probably the most important skill.
I mean, and these are the largest. Are these protests larger than the protests in 2008 when you had the your complete financial collapse?
I think larger and definitely more spontaneous. Mm. It kind of built up that time, you know, but now it was just, okay, we know the drill, you know, we're going to show up and get this guy out. And I think most people there expected it was just a formality for him to resign.
I see. Yeah, I was going to say Iceland is also either the only country or definitely one of the very few countries that actually put its corrupt, fraudulent bankers in jail. I mean, in this country, not a single banker involved in the 2008 collapse. Went to jail, but you guys actually jailed some of your top bankers, right?
A few of them, yeah. It is a pretty cushy jail, but it is jail. So,
I don't know about Iceland, but I have friends who are having a hard time in various ways, and they their last ditch comfort is, you know, I can always go to Denmark and commit a felony or something.
Well, I remember reading about Varg. I can't remember the black metal guy from Norway who killed one of his. But right, and he was complaining once he got put in jail in Norway how it was too comfortable, and he demanded that they treat him worse.
This is metal at all.
That Breivik character in Norway, he's been complaining that he only has a PS2. And he can't play any new games on that. So
wow,
it's terrible to be in prison here.
That's infuriating. Yeah. So
if he killed another 100 people, they might not even let him have a PS2. They get strict with the second 100.
Like first generation PlayStation, I think.
Wow. So I guess, you know, the other thing about Iceland, we were just talking about it, is you guys also have. WikiLeaks, as you said, was essentially born in Iceland. The first, before it became, it sort of went global, I guess before 2010, WikiLeaks was working and leaking some big stuff in Iceland, right? Is this how
Yeah, that kind of made my career, actually, because I found the document through a friend of mine, who's a mutual Facebook friend of John's and mine, and he pointed me in the right direction. I got the documents from WikiLeaks, and we put them on the air, and a whole, you know, media storm came down on us. The police arrived and tried to stop us from broadcasting, and, you know, it was a whole thing.
What were the documents, and what year was this?
This was 2009, and it was about the banks, who owed money to the banks and who they owed money to.
I see. Wow, that's great. Okay, so you obviously have a lot of experience in encrypted sort of communications, and I presume that helped you get in contact first with some of these people from Islamic State. So, John, I'll let you take it over.
We should explain that Gunnar has actually been in contact with guys in Islamic State online for quite a while, and that's really remarkable. Most people look at Islamic State and take their best guess, usually informed by some moral premise or other. And Gunnar has done something really extraordinary, which is to get to know these people and to talk to them for a long period. And I'm personally surprised that it can be done at all. So can you just start by telling us how you got into that?
Yeah, I was quite surprised myself. What I started by doing was just following them on Twitter, because I saw a lot of media reports that were quoting Twitter accounts. Mm-hmm. And back then, I mean, this was, 2013, 14, and they were kind of new, and they weren't getting blocked on Twitter so much. So
I remember that era. There were all kinds of, I mean, there was hashtag Islamic State, hashtag Khilafah, all that stuff.
Exactly. All you need to do was search a little and just add everybody you could. Then eventually you built up a sort of database of, you know, a couple of hundred ISIS people, supporters, and people in Syria, actually. And I just started to contact them, ask them if they could add me so I could send them a direct message. A few did, and they sort of guided me towards the dark web and the Tor browser, mm-hmm. and all this encrypted stuff. They even had their own software, which is constantly evolving.
Wow.
Who were the people you were in contact with first? I don't mean names. I mean, what kind of guys were
they? They were almost exclusively these famous, you know, Western jihadis that moved from Europe, often England, and went there because they were the ones with the language skills to really speak in English.
Mm. Right. Also, so English is the key language for communicating globally. Is that the idea behind their value?
Yeah, I guess so. I would imagine Arabic would be more helpful for their day-to-day purposes, but in spreading propaganda, there's a lot of, you know, people in England that don't speak Arabic, or Urdu speaker maybe,
right. Mm-hmm.
And they need some sort of pipeline to get in there, and it really was a pipeline. They all tried to recruit me.
Wow!
What were their recruitment techniques? How did they start?
Well, they started by saying, oh, you're quite knowledgeable about Islam and all this, and you should learn more, and just sending me links and propaganda stuff. And then they said I should come to Syria to report there, to see the reality of it, and actually explain to me how I would get there. It's quite simple. You just go to one of their designated hotels in Turkey, and you check in with a certain name. And I assume they have someone on staff checking daily who's coming in, and then someone just shows up and puts you in the trunk of a car and drives you to Syria.
Wow.
I had to pass on that one.
Yeah, that would be a little bit scary. No, that's just amazing. I mean, I was initially wondering if one of the reasons that they might have been also talking with you was just that they were also the types who, I mean, these are presumably young men looking for glory, and you know, you want to strike up a relationship with the journalists as well, because you want to brag to somebody into the world. Was there any of that, or what were these people like who you were talking to?
There was a lot of that. Mm-hmm. They were very conscious that anything they said might get into the media, so they tried to present a really good picture.
And a good picture or a boastful picture?
A boastful picture. You know, they posted some literal you know, images of themselves with Kalashnikovs and and all this. And then I would also get updates from the other ones, you know, if someone died, you know, I'd get a picture of his corpse holding one finger in the air posed, you know, like that's supposed to represent Tawheed, I think, the oneness of God. And they were quite eager to share that, actually. It surprised me.
Wow. Yeah, they have a real fondness for corpse pictures, including their own corpses, which is odd. You would think that would be bad propaganda.
Yeah, yeah. They always say, you know, we love death more than they love life and all this all this crap. So,
yeah, I've heard that one. That's an odd military slogan. I mean, the Japanese Imperial Army also loved death more than the U.S. Army did. It didn't turn out to be that useful. I mean, you have to be willing. Well, you have to be willing to kill as well. Do they talk about killing very much?
Yeah, quite a bit. I mean, someone did a statistical analysis of just the propaganda posts, and very few of them are actually about killing. Surprisingly, a lot of them are about basic services and how everything is wonderful, and they're, you know, have their own economy and this gold dinar nonsense. They kept going on about the gold dinar.
Oh, the dinar! Yes. I remember the whole dinar era. There was a dinar era on Twitter where, if you followed these accounts, where it was all they talked about. They were going to undo the whole corrupt world economy.
It's like Ron Paul, you know, with the gold standard.
Yeah, it was exactly that.
As you say, they're very conservative people. I think you said somewhere in an interview that these are very conservative young men, and their attitude towards women is part of the expression of that.
Exactly. They're sort of, you know, these young sort of, you know, chauvinistic sort of types who think that everything has gone to hell in the Western world and also in the Arab world, and the way to get things back on track is to be really conservative and go back not just to the Sunnah, but also the Sunnah being the, you know, the life of the Prophet and all that, but also to the caliphates that came after him. And there's a lot of nasty stuff that went on, obviously, in the Middle Ages and such, which they're actually trying to emulate. And you know, if you have this many centuries of history, you can always find some historical example of some caliph doing something horrible, and you just repeat that.
I'm curious. Go ahead.
One thing I found quite interesting was the backlash amongst. I also added some Jabhat Nusra people and Al Qaeda people, and there was a lot of back and forth. And the backlash that they got from burning that Jordanian pilot was like nothing I'd ever seen before. There were a lot of disgruntled people in the ranks about that one, because I believe it's specifically forbidden in the Quran to burn people alive, which is a handy commandment.
I love how they get all pedantic about what ways you can kill people and can't, and torture them. You know.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of pedantry, a lot of rules in Salafism.
Yeah, and as I understand, I think that whole deal about throwing gays off buildings is from some example of someone being thrown off a cliff, and it's just sort of a substitute. So they're winging it a little bit.
I see. So the backlash was who was complaining?
A lot of jihadis, you know, people.
I mean, foreign jihadis, but
not Islamic State jihadis, because they were the ones who did it, right? So it'd be the competing militias.
Yeah, and people on the fence. There's a lot of guys that say, you know, in their Twitter accounts, not affiliated with Al Qaeda or ISIS or all that. But then they, you know, post propaganda, and they appear to be quite supportive of most of the things they're doing. But yeah, it wasn't sort of a turf war.
Yet, you know, kind of an undecided voter who's primary. In the ideological camp.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm curious how much of the way that they spoke with you about why they, you know, were with the Islamic State and their propaganda, how much of that was grievances about, you know, the way they've been discriminated against? I mean, I'm talking mostly also about the foreign Islamic State jihadis. How much of their, you know, talk with you was about grievances about Islamophobia or discrimination, or, you know, basically local grievances, or how much compared to the boastful part or, you know, the conservative part about everything going to hell and the decadence of the West? I mean,
it's surprisingly little. They they don't like to cast themselves as victims.
Right.
They always try to pretend that they're proactive, and they actually, they spent more time condemning the Arab regimes and the kingdoms than they did the West. The West was sort of an afterthought, you know, that they're backing up the corrupt kingdoms, and that's why they have to go.
It's kind of like Bin Laden.
They're not. Yeah, they're not supposed to be good. They're supposed to be kufr. They're supposed to be the unbelievers. But I remember in Saudi, the more seriously Muslim people would say with real rage, "This is not Islam," because there's always that idea of the perfect caliphate, and you can't spend very long in Saudi without realizing this ain't it.
Yeah, and there was a lot of frustration with the guys who had actually gone to Syria and sort of, you know, gone all in the ISIS camp, that people weren't flocking to their cause because they need that, because, you know, it says in their predictions that everybody's going to join them eventually, and then they're going to suffer great losses, and they have this whole death cult thing planned out in advance, and anytime the narrative doesn't go their way, they get quite frustrated.
How did they respond to the things that are used most against them, like Yazidi sex slaves and the extermination of the Yazidi? Did they mention that sort of thing at all?
They were extremely happy about that. They were like, they would mention it without prompting, you know, that they had eliminated this. They called them devil worshippers because of the connection of the Yazidi deity to Shaitan, you know, the satanic figure of Islam.
Yeah, that's amazing. But I saw their article in Dabiq about that, and the first paragraph is like, not only will they not be punished for doing that, but the previous generations of Muslims who did not do it will be punished when they get to the afterlife.
I saw that article. It was quite amazing. It's brazen. And there was another article specifically dealing with how to deal with slaves, you know, women mostly from the Yazidi side.
It's interesting.
It
now that you mention it, they don't have a lot of interest in male slaves. It comes down pretty strictly, and this is a very modern imagination, you know, to sex slavery. I mean, when slavery was a real institution, that was a relatively minor branch of the game. But now it's the one that seems to interest them obsessively.
I think it was always part of it, you know, even in the Deep South in the United States, there was always this undertone of sexual slavery, but that seems to be the point here rather than labor.
Right. I want to ask sort of a more technical question about Tor and about you know, how safe the encryption and the dark web were in terms of communicating with these people. I mean, first of all, how hard is it to get into that world and be able to communicate with them, and maybe even explain to some of our listeners like what the dark web is, and, you know, briefly what it is and why they would communicate there.
Yeah, but basically Tor is the hidden dark underbelly of the internet, as people like to describe it in hyperbole. It's just sites that are not part of the sort of world wide web, but they're part of their own sub branch of the web that can only be accessed through certain software and by using encryption. And the reason they use that is the same reason why, you know, you may have heard about the Silk Road, the drug thing. It's quite safe if you don't count human error, which is always what brings everybody down. If you use it 100% correctly, you should be quite safe. Even the NSA, I'm not sure if they've completely cracked Tor. So you get a lot of weird stuff there, everything from, you know, pedophiles to conspiracy theories, and then they have, you know, these sort of chat rooms or question and answer sessions with ISIS, which is quite revealing, because of a lot of the questions from the other people that were there were about how to get there and what to bring, you know.
I want to come back to that for a second, because it's just beginning to hit me. These guys told you go to this hotel in this Turkish city. That implies
Go ahead, John, sorry.
That they have superb security, which if they're talking to somebody they just met doesn't seem likely, or that there's some pretty serious collusion with the Turkish security forces.
Yeah.
It does sound like that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's been an accusation from the start that the Turkish intelligence service is somehow in cahoots with them, or at least elements of it. And you know, after what we saw in Abbottabad in Pakistan, you'd believe almost anything of a secret service
Yeah, well, I think they're using the Pakistani model. The MIT, the Turkish intelligence service, is trying to do a sort of Kashmir deal and an Afghan deal at the same time with the various jihadi groups. I mean, this is it's like offering a very dangerous weapon. It's like offering the One Ring, basically, to an intelligence service. Like, you have this force that's not very bright on average and can be directed toward anybody you don't happen to like. And you don't have to report any of it because it's all off the books. I mean, it's a great temptation. And it's tempted regimes that were a lot less openly authoritarian and reactionary than Erdogan's.
Oh, certainly. It's an old game, even from the Cold War. It's really handy to have a bunch of these guys around until it's not handy, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
But worry about that later, you know.
Yeah. The attitude, until they show up in Ankara with an attitude and a suicide belt, it's all fun and games until that point.
So the Warlord is described as in various articles. John has described his idea of what the typical Islamic State recruit is like, particularly the foreign jihadis. Males, 15 to early 20s, not the brightest people, rather conventional in a way, and looking for glory and bigoted in their own way. So, I mean, how close, from your experience, has the Warner's descriptions of these people been?
It's absolutely spot on. Mm-hmm. My experience was exactly that these were sort of disgruntled, sort of, I'm not sure I want to use the word loser in this reference if somebody's listening, but they're sort of not successful in their old lives, and they see a chance for glory, and they're quite ready to be indoctrinated with anything. I was talking to John before this, and I was saying, I remember what I was like when I was 16, mm-hmm. Somebody gave me a harem and a gun, mm-hmm. I don't know what the hell I would have done.
Oh, yeah, I had to go find the last remnants of Irish nationalism in San Francisco to try to find a cause or something. Yeah. It was pathetic. I mean, and thank God it didn't happen when I was 18. That for me is part of the difficulty of talking honestly about this. And that's why it's so wonderful that you've actually talked to these guys and you're talking from experience, that so many people have a moral certainty from the beginning about what they are, either monsters or deprived kids or something like that, and none of those things really fit. But if you remember being 18, it's a lot easier. If you remember, as I always say, your physical education class in high school, what we called PE, the people you forget from there, the most ordinary of them. Mm-hmm. Well, jihad is kind of a middle of the curve phenomenon.
Yeah. If you don't really fit in any one group, and obviously this is a very small percentage of European Muslims that go there, so mm-hmm. it has to be something unique about them.
Absolutely. That's the other thing that people, that we need to remind people of all the time. This is an incredibly tiny percentage. Mm-hmm. It has to be, because the pool is so huge that if any serious percentage of the pool were joining jihad, it would be a much more serious force than it actually is.
Oh, definitely. We'd be talking millions if it was anything like the propaganda describes it on either
mm-hmm.
side.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, in another Warner article I recall, John, you said what's actually most remarkable is how few Sunni Muslims are interested in fighting and jihad and war and all this stuff that, compared to their numbers.
Yeah, especially when you apply that sort of adolescent, mm-hmm. personality that we've been talking about, it's very surprising and sort of cheering, except that the ones who do go sort of make up for that by being just off the scale horrible.
Yeah. It was strange to me that a lot of these people coming from the West were towing the party line quite hard on the Shia thing.
I was going to ask you about that. Is that their prime hate at the moment, the Shia?
It seems to be, yeah, which is surprising to me because it's not a big problem in the European countries I've lived in. It's not a lot of, sectarian conflict between Sunnis and Shias.
Yeah, but there never used to be, although I have seen some reports from the British press saying that British Muslim communities are splitting now into Shia groups and Sunni groups, which would be really sad if it happened.
Yeah, that's quite sad.
What about Jews in Israel? Where do they stand in the hate list?
Well, they're just basically Satan. You know, it's just a sort of a caricature of sort of like we think about Adolf Hitler. It's just you don't really need to mention him. It's,
yeah.
They just take it for granted that the Jews are ultimately behind everything.
Right. So the much more sort of active hate and anger is really about Shia more corruption in the Arab regimes.
Yeah, it's always that, you know, old human adage that everything that's almost like you but not quite is a lot worse than everything that's completely opposite of you. It's like, like John said, you know, you don't, as a Westerner, they have no expectation of you going to heaven or doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. You're serving a certain narrative in their books. You're supposed to be the evil guy who's allows them to be victorious by fighting you. And it's the traitors that they're really upset about.
And also, they've been losing on the battlefield to the Shia lately. That must intensify this. I mean, have they talked about the Russian intervention in Syria to you? Anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, they talked a big game. You know, like it's not going to affect us and all that. And one thing that's really surprised me, the change in narrative over the last few weeks, has been a lot of the sort of most atrocious videos they're posting are of their own men getting decapitated by alleged Shia militiamen and Assad forces.
So, that's really interesting because they were posting their own decapitations as
recruiting videos.
As recruiting videos. That's extraordinary.
It's quite hypocritical because you see all these guys holding up these very bearded heads and they say, oh, look, this is a horrible crime against Islam. And you're like, wait, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That, you know, there are all sorts of little signals in these videos that are meant to be sectarian. Like when the beard is longer than the head itself, that's usually a sign that this is somebody from Nusra or Islamic State. But another interesting thing I noticed about videos during the siege of Kobani was that, of course, jihadists can only like kittens and cats because dogs are haram. So you would have competing videos from the ruins of Kobani with a jihadi holding a little kitten, and then have the YPG women holding a puppy.
Oh my God.
As if to say, we're not following your rules.
It was the pet wars,
Sounds like BuzzFeed.
That's one of these funny things. They get into these memes, sort of, you know, like everybody has to have a kitten photo.
Right.
And then suddenly everybody was posting children with guns. That was a big thing for a while. And Nutella was one of the most surprising things. The pictures of jihadis holding up Nutella jars.
Wow. I mean, you want to humanize your guys, and so many things are haram that the list of those things that are not haram gets to be very precious to you.
Yeah, they had a lot of videos of them destroying alcohol, cigarettes, and even marijuana. They were burning this big bushel of marijuana and looked like they were quite enjoying it for more than one reason.
Wow.
Then they ran for the Nutella right away, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's a link there.
That's funny. So, John, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so have they said anything since the Russian intervention did, in fact, take effect? I mean, it would be hard to sustain a narrative that it didn't do any good at this point.
Yeah, they've been oddly quiet on that front. You know, everything is always going really well for them. If they retreat, it's a strategic retreat, and their propaganda often sounds a lot like what was his name, Baghdad Bob, that guy in the Iraq.
That's very true. They always do that. It's like, never mind that we're losing in Region A, we're doing great in Region F and G. But there was a trend like after Kobani, because that was the first time they lost in public. And everybody watched them lose, and it was a real shock. And I remember, I don't know if you saw anything like that, but even the public tweets, there were tweets like, pray for us, it's not easy when you're walking next to somebody and a bomb goes off, and some would say, it's not our enemies doing this, it's our sins doing this. And it was some domestic argument, it sounded like, within Islamic State.
Yeah, there's this predestination thing they struggle with. There was an article, I think, in Inspire, the Al-Qaeda magazine, rather than Dabiq, that was about how to deal with the death of comrades. And it was just called Don't Be Sad. Which was quite revealing. And the whole article was about, you know, of course it's sad when all your friends are being taken out by drones and blowing up in air raids. But, you know, you have to keep up the spirit, and, you know, you'll be with him one day and all that.
Right. Oh, that's so interesting. Because,
psychology.
If you're truly devout, it shouldn't be a tragedy at all. But one of the things you've said is, and you said in an interview that you might get beheaded for this, is that their Islamic knowledge and devotion is actually rather shallow on average, right?
Yeah, that's what struck me. I mean, some of them would say, oh, you know about Islam, when I would ask them about certain points and then not really answer back. And I got the feeling that a lot of them were being indoctrinated for the first time once they arrived in Syria and had not really been studying at mosque as children and you know, probably came from fairly liberal families and may have been sort of a rebellion.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. You mentioned that some of them described their parents as drinking and that this scandalized a lot of them.
Yeah, extremely. They were extremely conflicted about that. One of them, at least, which I talked to, because he's not supposed to talk ill of his parents under any circumstances. Mm. Right. Which is an Islamic thing, but you couldn't really hide the disgust that he had when he was describing the life that he had back in the West.
Yeah,
was it more middle class or more sort of working class? Or
he didn't really get into details about the economic background, but mostly just that they, you know, were apostates and had abandoned the religion that, you know, they were born with and hoped they would one day come to the Islamic State and blah, 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 all that, you know, and would realize the error of the ways.
That's one thing that I think a lot of people don't realize about the whole Salafist jihadi struggle, that it's a very defensive one. I mean, the power of Western culture is extraordinary. I saw this even in the most remote city in Saudi Arabia. I mean, they were having to make new rules to cope with the fact that there was a mall in town and that sometime young men and young women were at the mall at the same time. I mean, this is a reaction to a very powerful corrosion that's going on all the time.
Indeed, and they have these arguments about exactly what is haram and what is not. Regarding to technology, for example, they have this quite dubious fatwa that was making the rounds about how in jihad you had to use all the weapons of the enemy and all that. So they find ways around it.
Yeah. Well, the image thing is a problem to begin with. If you're making videos, I mean, if there are some people who put the ultimate strict construction on that, and those are haram too.
Ideally, they wouldn't be filmed at all. You know, that's their interpretation of Salafism, which is very strict on images, like you say, of living human beings.
But go ahead. I'm sorry.
There's one element that I've been struggling with until quite recently. That's how quickly they seem to flip once they get arrested. Like Abdesalam and all these guys that have been interrogated and are cooperating. That at first it didn't really mesh with my idea of them being completely intransigent, but maybe it's just that shallow. Maybe they just, you know, find themselves in a difficult situation and just give up the whole thing. I don't know.
If you're a joiner, you're a joiner, you know. And joiner is probably a good profile for a lot of these guys. Like when you're out of the influence of one group and under the influence of another group, which specialize in breaking people and making them new, you know, it's probably not that hard a transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably from one indoctrination camp to another. You know.
And no matter how. I mean, I'm just guessing here. I don't know. Does this sound right? No matter how much you loved the world of the caliphate, it can never be as familiar to you as the world you came from before. And there has to be a sense of returning there.
And you're always going to be worried about falling afoul of some law or a rule that you don't understand completely. I would be paranoid about that if I was a new recruit from the West, you know, and
yeah, one strike and you're out seems to be the rule. I mean, did they talk about any privations of living a strict Salafist life that got to them?
There was one interesting thing. There was one guy who was quite fat when he arrived in Syria, and he said that in just 3 months he had lost almost all the weight. I took that as meaning maybe the food wasn't too great, but he was quick to add that, you know, there were daily running exercises for 3 hours, and, you know, he was in great shape now.
Yeah, that's part of the whole military remake, right? That's classic. I joined the army, lost 30 pounds, and now I can kill with one finger.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean that's a traditional conventional adolescent initiation, right? So some of this will be very similar to that.
It is, yeah. And if you look at the training videos, it's a lot of pretty basic, you know, cardio. You know,
yeah.
It's guys running around. They don't have much equipment. They're climbing ropes. And, you know, it was sort of an old trope of Al-Qaeda days. There was this jungle gym footage of these people swinging on these bars.
Oh, right.
I remember. You need a montage.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about something, though. You seem to have an extraordinary ability to stay on good terms with these guys. Mm-hmm. Not only did you get in touch with them, which is very impressive, but you stayed in touch, it sounds like. I mean, because I've occasionally been in conversations that begin, "Are you interested in Islam in Saudi Arabia?" And eventually I just started answering no, and which is not exactly true, but I wanted to end the conversation. And that definitely ended the conversation. Nobody would talk to me from that group after that.
I think what helps me is I'm deeply interested in Islam. There's a Quran on my bedstand, and I've been in the region. I've been in Palestine and spoken to extremists there, and you know, I'm genuinely want to know what they have to
right.
say.
When did you become interested in Islam? And
well, my father is an expert in political Islam. He's a university professor, so. You know, from an early age, really. You know, he would send me letters from on Christmas from the West Bank, where he was in Bethlehem, and it was all quite interesting to me, and still is. But
go ahead.
You spoke about me being on good terms. You did read the part of the interview where I wasn't on good terms, didn't you?
Yes. But in general, you seem to have maintained a lot of these. What's your longest running contact?
This one guy I still have who has never actually told me where he is, but he's moved up in life because he allowed me to scoop the international media recently with the Brussels attacks. He declared responsibility before Al Hayat, you know, their media wing, or Al Amat actually in this case. But anyway, he was trying to get the word out to his friends and people online, and he used a new program which I'm not quite familiar with called Telegram, and I was just checking it out.
That's the Russian one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. And he had this channel set up that was full of, you know, apparently jihadis there, and like 5 minutes before it went out to the media, he told everyone to get ready to storm Twitter with this because we wouldn't have long until we all got banned. And so I just, you know, I was at work and I just, you know, went into our website, ruv.is, and wrote up, you know, Islamic State about to claim responsibility for Brussels attacks. And we were the first ones.
Congratulations.
Wow, yeah, congratulations. Telegram is the company or the software or whatever that was set up by, or the technology set up by Pavel Durov. The Russian who founded Vkontakte, which is the Russian Facebook, and it was eventually taken away from him by the Kremlin, and he fled the country. And I think he lives in he lives in London, I think. And he's kind of an asshole. Like he's made a lot of money for himself, but he's famous for a few years ago when he first got rich off Vkontakte. He would throw 500 ruble bills out the window and watch the poor Russians scramble for it and that kind of stuff. But Telegram is really big now. It's getting very big, and I know the Kremlin hates Telegram. So,
yeah, they seem to be gravitating towards that. They're having a hard time with all the other social media now. Since Paris and Brussels, people are really reporting them quite a lot.
So they're gravitating towards Telegram. How safe is it? Because I saw somewhere on Twitter where Snowden was saying there was something in Telegram, and he had on Twitter a little back and forth with Durov, and he said he didn't think it was so safe.
Probably not very safe. You know, these guys aren't geniuses, but they just want to get the word out.
Right.
So you said something really interesting that I'd like to ask you about. You said you've been in contact with Palestinian Islamists as well as Western Volunteers for Islamic State. What would you say are the differences between the two groups as you've seen?
definitely nationalism. You know, there's the Palestinian cause always has this nationalist undertone that would be abhorrent to these guys in Syria.
Right, right. Al-Baghdadi is famous for saying Iraq is not for the Iraqis, Syria is not for the Syrians, but the whole world belongs to Allah.
Exactly. And they don't actually recognize any borders. They just recognize their sort of fighting fronts. You know, they plan to claim the whole planet eventually. So
you don't see it so much lately, but when they were still getting on Twitter a lot of the time, you'd see these amazing maps where I recall one where Greenland was in the black of jihad. And how are you going to get to Greenland?
Yeah, I remember that map, and I saw a more recent one that claimed they had set up caliphates in all kinds of countries, obviously Belgium and France, but also England, and they have pictures of people standing in the Welsh countryside holding ISIS flags. Wow. Like, you know, I guess if you can't contribute anything else, you take a picture of yourself with a flag in Wales.
Yeah, but they'd better put that flag in Welsh, if I understand, you know. They got a real language controversy going.
They're going to need a bigger flag for that, I think.
So did the Islamic State guys you spoke with, did they talk about the Palestine problem at all? I mean, is it something that inspires them at all?
Probably just generally, you know, like all Muslims talk the talk about Palestine. It's not a big concern for them because they're sort of claim to be pushing towards Israel, which they're obviously not doing because they'd get crushed.
Right.
Al-Baghdadi has gotten some heat for this. I mean, to the point that he gave a speech a few months ago saying, oh, the Jews think we are not paying any attention to them because we're dealing with these other enemies. Don't you worry, we'll get to you in good time, which is, an almost always disingenuous sort of thing to say. It means they are not, in fact, dealing with them. And as I've said a lot of times, Israel is weirdly quiet about what's going on just north of its border.
Well, there was the Hillary email, right, where she said that, from the Israeli point of view, and now I get it, talking with Gunnar, the Israeli point of view was, well, these sides are just going to kill each other. That's fine with us. Let's encourage it.
Yeah, she said outright, a Sunni-Shia war from the Israeli perspective would not be a bad thing.
And that's what Islamic State seems to be much more focused on than anything else, as what Gunnar's saying, right?
Yeah.
I remember one really telling moment from my exchange with one of them. He said, you want to see a video of something more disgusting than anything you've seen before? And I figured, okay, this is going to be pretty bad. And this was a guy who had shared with me earlier a video of a tank actually producing a pancake out of a human being.
Wow.
And it was ridiculous. It was like the cartoon version to see. But this video he sent me, which was the most disgusting he'd ever seen, was from a Shia mosque where people were crawling on the ground and, you know, prostrating themselves before a shrine of Ali or something like that.
The shrine thing. Yeah, it's weird echoes of the Reformation there. You know, the reinforced prohibition on idols and statues. And yeah, but I wonder how real any of that must be for somebody who came from Birmingham. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I guess he's learning on the ground, you know, who the real enemy is.
Yeah.
There was an interesting revelation in the New York Times recently about this guy who was supposed to be part of the Brussels attacks, I believe. And he had been taken in by intelligence services and really spilled the beans because he said he came to Syria to fight Assad. And, you know, he joined up with Islamic State. And only 3 days later, he was sent back and told to attack, you know, France and Belgium. And he didn't really have a big beef with France or Belgium.
Right. One thing you can tell from the recruiting patterns is that it's a lot harder to make people attack the country where they grew up than to get them to attack on a front where they have no family, no friends, nothing.
That's why ex-prisoners seem to make up a lot of the local attackers in France and Belgium.
Right? Yeah, they've got a grudge.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, these are very specific types of people. They were, you know, often petty criminals, done time together, and you know, it was just another gang to join, the baddest gang around,
right.
You know.
Yeah. So, did you actually? I have to know. Did you actually get in trouble? Tell us about the reaction if your friends saw that interview. Your contacts. Did any of them see the interview with where you called their Islamic knowledge shallow?
what actually happened was I had to reinvent myself a while back because I got into trouble originally with them because I saw some footage that they were posting of a victory, and they said, you know, we'll give more details later. And idiotically, I just posted back, hey, salam alaikum, is this in Anbar province? And evidently it was, because he went absolutely apeshit and said I was a spy, and I saw my name on like the profiles of like 30 jihadis on my contact list posting my name and my picture and saying I was, you know, a spy for NATO and all this stuff.
Yeah, I was wondering how much paranoia goes on there and towards you as well.
I have a new account.
I see. But I mean, are they generally as concerned and worried about, you know, spies and moles, and are they paranoid about it as much as one would think, or no?
It seems to be they're quite paranoid about it, but it only seems to occur to them after they've spoken to me.
Yeah.
It's very internet behavior.
That's really amazing. I mean, and yet that seems to be true. Yeah. So you revealed some geographical knowledge, and that set them off, but nothing else set them off.
No, nothing. I mean, I would ask them about everything. You know, I mean, I asked one of them to go on a mission for me and check out if any Icelanders were in the foreign fighters camp. And he reported back the next day, no, I met some Norwegians and Danes and Swedes, but nobody from Iceland. You know.
So, okay, well, note to any spies listening, if you, as long as you don't reveal any knowledge of Anbar province, you should be okay.
You'd think that would be privileged information, that stuff foreign fighters, you know, but no.
Well, especially because you could probably guess where this guy was depending on what ethnic makeup he said he found at the camp.
Yeah, I believe this was somewhere in the vicinity of Raqqa. He had mentioned that earlier, but this guy actually died in Kobani eventually.
Oh, wow.
You told the interviewer something really amazing that I'd like you to talk about if you can, that you've seen video of the studio in which some of these execution films are made, right?
Oh, yeah, that was really interesting. It was apparently from a media center in Raqqa, which is their main city in Syria and sort of, you know, their preferred urban environment. But it appeared to be, it was a large green screen with a guy dressed just like Jihadi John in the black overalls and the hood. And he was standing with an orange-clad prisoner at his knees and brandishing a knife at his throat. It was about 10 or 15 seconds long, this video, and taken from afar, and you could see all the production around it, all the production people with the mics and the cameras and everything. And then they had this big fan off to the left, which was blowing wind on them, like to make it appear they were outside.
Wow. It's also like a real music video.
Yeah. And it certainly just dawned on me, like, of course they can't film this with a big crew out in the desert, you know, with their production values, they would be spotted from the air quite easily.
Yeah, I wondered about that. Like, goddamn, it's hard to film things. You need a lot of people, and this is a completely open countryside. But until you said that, it never occurred to me that they actually film this indoors and just do a sort of desert for studio effect.
Yeah, it was just a background of sand dunes or something, you know, probably public domain.
So presumably they, I mean, they've also recruited all kinds of people in the arts and theater and cinema or television and so on, right? I mean, where would they get these? Do you know much about how this developed, the idea that eventually they bring things into movies, into, you know, makeshift TV studios and have fans blowing in their hair like a Bon Jovi video or something? Like, where do they get, how do they get to that point?
They obviously have someone who's worked in the Western media, maybe even advertising, the way the things are shot. And, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about who it might be. At one time, someone said it might be an Icelandic person, which is what prompted my investigation. That turned out to be false. Uh-huh. The man who was named in the media was quick to reiterate that he was not in Islamic State. He was, in fact, I believe, in Canada or somewhere. And so that sort of went away. I mean, if you just look at Dabiq, you can see that whoever makes Dabiq, he has experience with layouts, you know.
Yes, Dabiq is a remarkably glossy magazine. I don't know if it's still online, but people should give it a look if it is, because you're reading something that looks like an airline magazine, and it's rejoicing over the extermination of an entire ethnic group as God's will. It's really extraordinary.
It is. And if you've noticed, the narrative has changed a little bit in the Beak. It used to be a lot about the, obviously, the success they were having and calling for recruits. But now it's a lot of theological arguments about, you know, how jihad is justified,
right,
and specifically against the Shia.
Mm. Yeah.
Why do you think the shift is taking place?
Well, there's not much victory to talk about, and there's a lot of controversy within the ranks of the sort of Salafist community about this. I've spoken to hardline Islamists that are very opposed to ISIS on theological grounds.
And so they might be having recruiting problems even if that's going on a lot. Or
yeah, it wouldn't surprise me with the news going badly, and you know they're fighting on the ideological front now. That sort of gives me an indication that recruiting isn't quite as what it used to be.
Mm-hmm. But as you say, and as we have both said, the real combat strength of Islamic State comes from angry Iraqis, right? They may not get any more guys from Birmingham or Brussels, and that may really affect their public relations, but it shouldn't have much effect on their real combat power.
Yeah, it's the Sunni triangle, the old Sunni elite that has been marginalized under the, you know, successive Shia regimes, Maliki, notably,
yeah.
And you know they're the rank and file of their fighting force. There's these foreign fighters have always been a minority. They just get the most attention because it's, you know, it's really interesting.
Yep. Oh, it's incredibly fascinating. But yeah, I remember when I was young. You know, you could be, I don't know, there was a year, like 1 year, I think, where if you were a skinhead, you could be totally ignorant and worthless, which most of them were, but you'd still get on a talk show. You know?
yeah, the Jerry Springer years.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And everyone would be scared of you.
Yeah.
Which is what a lot of these guys want, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like when they get Satanists to speak, and they get these really doped-out guys with black tattoos on their face, and you know, it's not really what Satanism is about, the LaVey kind of Anton LaVey Satanism, which is basically just glorified atheism, but you know, it sells papers.
Yeah. So what do you see as the happening in the next year with Islamic State based on your contacts?
Well, you're probably in a better position to speculate on that. I try to be an expert on ISIS, but I often defer to your analysis. Actually,
that's far too kind of you. I have to say I've never done anything like what you've done. I wouldn't have thought it could be done. It's really really impressive.
Well,
but I guess yeah, go on.
What I did was just to try to get beyond the narrative that you were speaking about, that you see this really, you know, sort of judgment-laden text coming from the Western media, and it's not very critical of any of the ideas that are being presented. So I thought I'd float it by the guys themselves and see what came out of it. And
it was a brilliant project. Have you thought about getting a book out of it?
Yeah.
I am writing a book, actually. It's okay. Not sure about when it's coming out or in what language, but I'm writing it, definitely.
Excellent.
Oh, well, put it in English. Well, that's where all the money is. And like all Icelanders, you speak better English than we do.
Well, mostly, yeah. It's a bit of a myth, like that we believe in elves. That, for the record, is not true.
No elves? Ah.
Oh, yeah, now we're disappointed.
Yeah.
We're not completely brain damaged. It's just a tourist thing, you know. But
yeah, okay.
But back to the future of ISIS, you know, just briefly, I think that the key to this is going to be the Kurds, as before. You know, I don't know if you read recent reports, but they're going bankrupt, apparently, because of disputes with the Iraqi government about oil revenue and other things. Wages are not being paid, and they're really having trouble keeping their fighting forces equipped.
Yeah.
So you know, if the United States stops having that ground force to rely on, it's hard to see the bombing campaign being very effective.
No, bombing alone won't do it. Yeah, that's right. I spent a year in Kurdistan, and I usually try not to get involved with my topics. It's better not to have any grudges or moral crusades. But they're remarkable people, and they've willed themselves out of the mess that is infecting most of the Middle East. And it would be really awful if they got sold out, and I strongly suspect they will be.
I think everyone that has contact with the Kurds comes away impressed. It's just they're impressive people.
Yep.
Okay, right. Well, we've gone close to an hour. I really appreciate you taking all this time, Gunnar. And if and when your book, well, not if, when your book comes out, we'd love to have you back on the show and any other time also, but definitely to promote your book.
Yeah, thanks, Gunnar. This was a great interview. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, and please do a memorial edition if I get beheaded after this one.
Well, that's a problem.
Better yet, we'll do a video.
Yeah.
Staged. All right.
I'll have my people contact your people.
All right.
Thanks again, Gunnar. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
White line fever. The years keep flying by like the highline poles. The wrinkles in my forehead show the miles I put behind me, and they continue to remind how fast I'm growing old. Guess I'll die with this fever in my soul.
Okay, so that was Gunnar Jonsson from Iceland Public Radio. It was a great interview, and thank you again to Gunnar for joining us on Radio War Nerd.
Yes, thanks very much.
Yeah, it's just really fascinating, and you know,
we hope we'll be able to talk to Gunnar again.
I know, definitely, and for his book and so on. Yeah, that was amazing. So, and getting back to what he spoke about at the beginning of the interview, the Panama Papers, I was telling you this. I every time I see a major leak story, suddenly the lead guy at the Guardian, his name appears, and it's Luke Harding. The hack burglar, as we called him at the Exile. So he was known, famous, infamous in 2006-07 or so, when he first came out, for repeatedly, blatantly, without even any fear or conscience, plagiarizing local English language journalists. He didn't know Russian, as I recall, and he was plagiarizing Kevin O'Flynn. I mean, that was when I first started hearing about it. You know, people were sort of joking that Kevin O'Flynn, who was with the Moscow Times, he went from sports to politics. Great guy, too. People were joking that Kevin O'Flynn took a second job with The Guardian, called himself Luke Harding, because he was just rewriting his stories. And then he started rewriting the Exile stories. And that seemed to me suicidal, knowing what the Exile had done, because, you know.
Yeah, why did he think he would get away with that?
That's something we never understood, to be honest. And it raises some weird issue questions. I mean, it really does.
Yeah, you should tell people what happened exactly, and then we'll get into it.
Well, so one of the stories, the most blatant story that he plagiarized, it was a story that Yasha Levine and I wrote for The Exile on, the downfall or what was happening with the Jewish oligarchs. Because in the 90s under Yeltsin, it was widely known that most of the oligarchs were Jewish. And so Harding in The Guardian not only plagiarized this, but actually word for word. So the first three paragraphs, I mean, he didn't even wait like a professional plagiarist who would be a little careful and put the plagiarized parts, you know, in the middle of the story. He put it at the top, word for word. So we contacted a lawyer. We thought, this is insane. This is so insane. And, you know,
And he published this in The Guardian, right?
In The Guardian, yeah. Paper. It's the largest online, I think it's the largest English language online readership in the world of any newspaper. And so we talked to a lawyer that, you know, what the hell should we do here? I mean, we've done everything in the past. We thought that journalist pretty much stayed away from us by that time, particularly after we threw a horse sperm pie in a New York Times correspondent's face for his bad articles. We used to, you know, we were pretty brutal. And so we kind of had I think most journalists there knew you just stay away from us, the Exile.
Or you suck up.
Or you suck up, yes.
I witnessed quite a lot of amazing sucking up.
Yeah. And we were very welcome to being sucked up to. You know? It's much better than this. So Ben Harding just sort of rolls into town and starts ripping off everybody, ripped us off. So we just thought, you know what? We're going to do something absolutely crazy. We're going to do this the white man's way. And so we got a lawyer involved, and we called up and wrote official letters, you know, to the editors at The Guardian. We had a lawyer following it up. And to our surprise, they panicked. And then we billed them. When they didn't get back, when they didn't respond quickly enough to us, we actually sent them an invoice for like £1,000 plus VAT for the stolen.
So you rated the three paragraphs at something like £330 per paragraph.
Well, yeah, we thought we were actually being, you know, pretty kind here, because what we really wanted more than anything was a retraction and a correction and apology. We wanted right. that, because that's a that is usually a deadly stain on a journalist's career. I mean, yep. usually that's it for a journalist. They can't do anything anymore after that.
Or at least they have to wait a few years.
Yes.
And, you know, go get a real job in the meantime.
Yes. And in fact, I'm going to call this up real quickly if I can find it here. Luke Harding. So we sent them an invoice, and then I called again before we published another edition of The Exile. We started calling this out in The Exile. And to my surprise, the editor actually was in a panic. He knew what was going on, so it was clear that they were talking about it and didn't know what to do and hoped it went away, and it didn't. So when I called him, and he took the phone, he's like, I'm on deadline right now, and he was in a complete panic, and he assured me that their new ombudsman, which was the first time a British newspaper ever even had an ombudsman, ombudsmen are very rare now, but they used to be pretty common in American newspapers, that she was looking into it. And the result was, I'll read this to you, they wound up affixing, and it's still there for anyone to see.
I just saw it today.
Yeah. I'll read the apology that is still there at the top of the story. It was published in the online edition, and it was published, and it's still there. I'm sorry, it was published in a newsprint edition, a correction, and then they affixed it to the top, and here's what it says. The following apology was printed in The Guardian's Corrections and Clarifications column, Monday, August 20th, 2007. The introduction to the article below included three paragraphs that were substantially similar to paragraphs contained in the introduction to another earlier article published in May in The Exile, an English-language newspaper based in Moscow. We should not have used material from The Exile in our introduction without quoting and crediting it properly, and we apologize to The Exile for this error. Now, you know, if you know what a punk newspaper The Exile is, this apology was, you know, worth more than its weight in gold.
Absolutely. But there's one other thing that struck me about it when I looked over it today. Usually a newspaper would throw the reporter under the bus for a lot less than this.
Yeah.
But instead, there's absolutely nothing about Luke Harding, and it's all, we did this,
exactly.
And we did that. Which they didn't. He did it.
Yep. And apparently, there was a history of this, and Private Eye actually wound up writing up something when he was doing the WikiLeaks. He was sort of the main guy in the WikiLeaks leaks. And so Private Eye went after him, and he was doing this back in Germany as well. So there's something really weird going on with him.
He's got photos of somebody. I don't know.
Photos of somebody, you know, he maybe he's an editor's dream, because he puts out all the bait, you know, bait clicks will at the drop of a hat. He's very easy to work with. He's a plant, you know, for some other powerful, important people. You know, who knows? It's pretty, you know, it doesn't happen like this with most other journalists.
And it shouldn't. I mean, people get thrown under the bus for things that would turn out to be right. I mean,
Gary Webb.
Here's Gary Webb. Yeah. There's Luke Harding.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, but look at the difference.
Him in Moscow when he was, his stay over in Moscow continued after this, right?
Yeah, it continued, and then he made a big show of having been kicked out of Russia because he was denied a visa, and it turned out the foreign ministry immediately issued him a fresh one. He hadn't renewed his visa, and he made a huge big deal out of it. It was, I mean, it was BS. Like, if they didn't want him in, they wouldn't have immediately issued him a new one.
Right.
They just didn't need it, and, you know, and he just... He's been the lead guy on the WikiLeaks stories, on the Snowden leaks stories, and then now on the Panama leaks stories. It's a guy who just blatantly ripped us off. And in fact, I'll tell you something else, which it was so crazy. We followed it up a bit in the X-Hub. We just thought this guy is nuts. He started plagiarizing from us again after all of this.
You almost got to admire it.
Yes, that's what we said. At this point, you have to admire the guy. Like, you know, Luke Harding for president of the United Nations at this point.
He's the Trump of journalism.
All right, so that's my Panama leak story. I think it's become...
Tell everybody the headline to that story so they can look up this amazing groveling headline.
You know what? You'll have to give me a minute because I'm looking at a screenshot that doesn't have the headline. But yeah, so I'll put it in the newsletter or something. I'll put it somewhere the headline for it. Yeah, but if you look up Luke Harding, Guardian, the Exile Correction, you'll find it. The other thing about the Panama leaks, I think, which is interesting, is the amount of skepticism that's greeting it from. I mean, not from the top part of the mainstream media and so on, but from the next layer down, I guess, from people who might have been more fans of the WikiLeaks leaks and the Snowden leaks, because everyone's saying, wait a minute, this is like supposedly the hugest leaks ever, and yet there's no American here. And in fact, you know, and it just happens to implicate, Putin and China and the people that we want out of power. But of course, it's not that simple. It also took down the Icelandic prime minister.
And then Cameron's father, if I understand.
Yeah, Cameron's father. But that's not really being highlighted as much as Putin's. The thing, and also the thing about the revelations about Putin is that these are not blockbuster by Putin corruption standards. I mean, there's been this kind of Putin corruption porn where they've had to up it and up it and up it over the years. So in 2007, the big revelation was supposedly he controlled $40 billion. And then in 2011, new revelations, he supposedly controlled $70 billion. And then 2015, it was $200 billion. You know, it becomes like Dr. Evil, you know, $200 billion. And now it's the Panama Papers show that a cellist who's close to him, he moved $2 billion around. It's like, okay, it's just not that exciting by Putin corruption standards.
So. No, my actual reaction was sort of, wow, he's got a cellist for a best friend. That's kind of cool.
I know. But yeah, a cellist who moves money around. I mean, how silly.
Yeah,
that's why everybody loves Putin. That's why they write about him. I mean, you know, he's a great villain.
Well, I can't imagine. I mean, you tell me. You know more than I do. But I can't imagine this hurting him in Russia anyway.
No, this hasn't. But again, the expectations weren't there either. This is not a shocker in any way. Unlike Iceland, as we heard from Gunnar, you know, in Iceland, this guy literally came to power saying he was going to fight this. He was not going to be the kind of guy who'd do exactly what he was just caught doing. So, yeah.
Yeah, Putin had a different set of promises.
Yes.
They don't really involve any claim of personal purity, except maybe in the sense that he doesn't drink and he's not a buffoon like Yeltsin is.
Well, and also, you know, Putin's corruption is not so that he lavishes himself with this ridiculous lifestyle. It's to influence. I mean, it's how he influences and maintains power. And I think people understand that as well. He's not hugely flashy in a sort of, I don't know, like a sheik from one of the Gulf sheiks or something. I mean, he's... And also the thing about Putin that is lost in this story is that one of the huge differences between Putin and Yeltsin, and you know, you'll notice that no one in the 90s, when Yeltsin oversaw the most corrupt regime probably in history, you didn't have the Western press digging into that until it all collapsed. In fact, they defended and protected him. But what Putin did, unlike Yeltsin, was Putin got the oligarchs to pay taxes. I mean, that's probably his greatest achievement. It's how he kind of wound up stabilizing the state, unlike Yeltsin. Couldn't get anybody to pay taxes. Everything was offshored. And so that also, I think, you know, blunts to a certain extent how effective this is. Because this is really about tax avoidance as well as hiding assets.
Understand one thing before we go. You understand finance way better than I do. And there's something I've been wondering. Some of the stories have said there are no Americans because Americans don't have to resort to this. That's why there's Delaware.
No. I mean, Apple itself has avoided, which is really stealing $60 billion in corporate taxes by setting up fake shell companies in Ireland. Ireland is a big, you know, when we talked with Jason Walsh, we talked about this. A lot of companies are set up in Ireland because you can just pay the local tax. However they work out these international treaty tax schemes, the way it winds up being is that you can avoid American taxes. So right. Something like a third or more, two-thirds or something of Fortune 500 companies don't even pay any taxes to the American government. It's theft. Yeah. And so that's BS. Americans just use different schemes, including Delaware and Nevada, but also usually Caribbean islands. We just use different schemes than the Panama scheme.
That suggests that this was a choice on someone's part to pick a particular dirty firm that handled mainly non-American clients.
Yeah, that's there are a few possibilities. One is it was just a principled whistleblower, but most whistleblowers have strange histories anyway. Warren Hinkle wrote a great thing on whistleblowers because he was one of the first journalists to use them. And he talked about the whistleblowers he knew and how they, as he could said, they did the Russ Kalnikov rope dance and they were usually very troubled people and so on. But so either it's a totally principled, which would be weird, you know, whistleblower who happened to work in an offshore sleazy law firm. Corporate espionage, private corporate espionage is a huge business. And these guys steal each other's stuff and leak it to journalists all the time. And they tend to be, you know, privatized state intelligence people, so the people who work with or as agents of some state intelligence agency.
That fits perfectly with what I know about defense contract whistleblowing. Yes. Because recently there was an item that came out about a DEA Defense Department co-contract to buy a drug control plane for Afghanistan. And it was a big expose. And then you look at the actual figure, and it's $86 million. And at that point, my first thought is, who's hiding something 10 times bigger by ratting on a small dealer like this?
Mm-hmm.
Because when something like that comes out, a lot of times it's to deflect attention from an even bigger, often much bigger fraud, like, say, the F-35.
Right. No, sorry about that. Yeah, no, exactly. That's why I was wondering if it's... If it's somehow connected to like rival firms, apparently, I mean, some people have tried to trace it to that. There's a big hedge fund guy who, a vulture fund guy, I can't remember his name right now, at the top of my head, Paul Singer, who bought up all of Argentina's defaulted bonds years ago and then went through the courts, did all this stuff, and finally got Argentina to pay him off. So he bought them he bought billions of dollars of their bonds off of all these jilted investors that collapsed in 2000 for like cents on the dollar. Went to the American courts with them, and then finally Argentina just voted in a right-wing rich, you know, neoliberal president, and now they're going to honor them. So that investment's paying off billions of dollars. And apparently this firm was somehow in the middle of it on one side or the other. That's one theory anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So
we're in very murky waters here.
Yes. I, by the way, if you heard me clicking or anything, I found the name of the Luke Harding story in The Guardian, which has the great correction at the top. It's called The Richer They Come, ... It's from July 2nd, 2007 by Luke Harding, and it's called The Richer They Come, Can Russia's Oligarchs Keep Their Billions and Their Freedom by Luke Harding. And I'll put in some links to the articles that we wrote about this as well for subscribers. Okay, so moving along from there, something that happened in your part of the world thousands of years ago, Hannibal.
An incredibly cool story. And it's got, as we say in the journalism business, because we're in the journalism business here, it has a local angle. For almost 2,000 years, there's been a lot of debate about where exactly Hannibal's army crossed the Alps, right? That was his big military coup. Because the Romans thought of the Alps as an impregnable barrier. And suddenly Hannibal's strange, motley, mostly mercenary army came down out of the Alps onto the plain of the River Po, and Rome was completely undefended. So it's never been entirely clear where he crossed. And because one thing about this area is that it's localism is very strong here. You know, it's people don't feel loyalty. I don't think, I'm no expert, but I don't think they feel loyalty so much to the cause of Italy in general as to your city or even your valley. Like there's a valley here called Val d'Aosta, which has this intense local patriotism. So every local valley was sort of crossing its fingers that it would turn out to be the place where Hannibal crossed. And finally, an archaeological team did a dig on one of these passes, a pass called the Traversette. I had to ask my mountaineering friend Annibale. That's an interesting coincidence that he's called Annibale. I had to ask him what col means. It means a pass, basically. And col de Traversette means something like, you know, the crossing pass. So it must have been a likely candidate. But this team dug down to a layer roughly equivalent to 3rd century BC when Hannibal crossed, and they found large amounts of horse dung. So, you know, once again, horse shit saves the day, in this case by revealing that it's very likely that Hannibal crossed at this point, because there's no other reason that you would have a large number of horses on this high mountain pass.
Can we say that horse shit doesn't lie?
Horse shit don't lie.
Ba-boom, ba-boom. All right. Tip the waitresses.
Yeah. And I was talking to my incredibly learned friend Annibale about this, and among other things, he's an expert on ancient warfare. And he said that the choice of Col de Traversette is a little bit surprising because it's a small pass, and when you consider this was a fairly big army, including elephants. By the way, they didn't find any elephant dung yet, because that would really settle the matter. There's only one possible reason for elephants to be up in the Alps. Anyway, he said this is a very narrow pass. It's a good pass until you get to the Italian side. Crossing it from the French side is pretty good, but when you come down on the Italian side, you're going to have a very steep descent. And, you know, if you can imagine leading elephants over a narrow, steep pass, it must have been hell on earth. But he said that once you get down from Col de Traversette, you find the river Po, and all you have to do, because Hannibal's army was in a new country and it didn't know the way very well, all you have to do from Col de Traversette is follow the river, and it will take you to this city, Turin, which was a Roman city at the time, defended by a tribe called the Taurini, which is where the city gets its name. And that's what Hannibal did. He followed the Po to early Turin, Torino, and crushed the Taurini, and then headed south. And this is where the Carthaginian victories start to get strange, because as people probably know, Hannibal did not take Rome. And there's always been some question about why he didn't take Rome. So I said to Annibale, okay, if he finds Turin, heads south, how can he lose? Why couldn't he just take Rome? There was virtually no defense. And he said, the trouble is, victorious armies get stupid and unless they're really held in a tight rein. That a lot of the point of military discipline is not to handle defeat so much as to handle victory, especially when you got a mercenary army, because Italy was a very rich land by comparison with wherever the hellhole most of these guys came from. Mm-hmm. So they sacked Turin. They come into a land like this that's incredibly rich and beautiful, and was even then, and peaceful, unlike almost every place else in the world. And they start to loot and rape and pillage with the occasional killing, and you can't get them to go anywhere. You know, they're not drivable anymore. They're not in the war to help Carthage. Very few of these people were Carthaginian. What you had in the Carthaginian army, somewhat like the Prussian army, was a local elite, incredibly ruthless, but without local soldiers who were any good. the local soldiers, as you see in Salambo, a great
novel. Yeah, I was just thinking about Salambo, which is about the aftermath and trying to deal with this giant mercenary
army. The aftermath
army.
Of the slave revolt. Yeah,
right.
And the Carthaginians, when they finally defeated the slave revolt through guile, were incredibly brutal, even by standards of the time, as they say. But they had to sort of get the slaves to turn on each other. Mm-hmm. And Narhavas is the one who turns on them in Salambo. So they lost control of the army, basically. Hannibal apparently wanted to move on Rome, but his army half disintegrated and half just slowed way, way, way down. And the Romans delayed. That's where the, Fabian socialism comes from. Fabius, the Roman commander who advocated a strategy of running away, basically, running away so that he wouldn't be destroyed, which is what would have happened if they'd faced the army. And after a while, they were able to build a better army and defeat the Carthaginians. But now we know where they came in, and it's pretty amazing. This pass is 60 kilometers, not quite west, a little south, but basically west of Turin. And once you get over those mountains, this is a really flat place. Mm-hmm. It would have been an easy ride.
Hmm. Yeah, you've talked a lot, I think, in your past, going way back, in Warnard articles about how victory makes you stupid. It's kind of heartwarming to know it made them stupid too. It's not just
Absolutely.
Our time.
Yeah, they'd never seen riches like this, I'm sure, because the Roman Empire was a really good thing if you happened to be inside it. And the closer you were to the center, the better it was. And Luca mentioned one other thing that's really interesting. Navigation. There's a peak here. You can see it even from intersections in downtown Turin called Monviso. And it looks like a perfect pyramid. In fact, every time I see it, I think of a line that Jane Dornacker sang back in the 1970s when there was all that pyramid fad stuff. Mm. Oh, a pyramid may keep your razor sharp, but a triangle will keep you on your toes. And this really looks like a perfect 1970s New Age pyramid. And apparently that was very important because it gave you a fixed point that would allow you to determine where you were once you went down onto the plain and lost the landmarks of the mountains. The part I don't get, though, I haven't been able to make it to the pass yet, but the part I don't get is getting the elephants down from the Alps. But that's always been, for me, the saddest part of the whole story because, that North African elephant species is extinct now. Mm-hmm. And not because Hannibal took them all over the Alps. Mm-hmm. They lasted a little while after that, but because the Romans, the winners and officially the good guys, liked seeing them killed in the Colosseum in horrible ways, and they used them all up, and they're gone.
Yeah, there were 37 elephants, is that right?
Yeah. I've heard that figure, but I couldn't swear to it. Mm-hmm. After talking to Annibale, I know how little I know.
So moving on there, just one of the big sort of conflagrations, wars that heated up in between last show and this show, which we decided to put off because there's so much to talk about, but is the Nagorno-Karabakh separatist war between the Armenian Nagorno-Karabakh Armenians and the Azerbaijanis. I think we've decided it's a little bit too complicated, and it has tentacles that go in a lot of different directions, both geopolitically and sort of in general war strategy and war stories that we've talked about. So we're going to, I think, put that off for more detail for the next show. But
yeah. We're going to give you a sort of unified field theory of contemporary war nerdery using Nagorno-Karabakh.
Yeah. One thing I can say, so that I had a question about if Azerbaijan, I mean, the way I understand it is Azerbaijan, so this is a separatist, largely Armenian or now definitely fully Armenian enclave within Azerbaijan's, official territory. The Armenians control something like 14 to 17% of Azerbaijan territory, but Azerbaijan has gotten very rich in the last 20 years from its oil. While both leaders were in Washington, I think, on a nuclear summit, either this thing spun out of control or it was a planned sort of probing act by Azerbaijan, because Azerbaijan, of course, wants to get their land back, what they consider their land anyway, and they have a lot of weapons that they bought during the oil boom, and now there's an oil bust, and you want to also distract the population. All these oil countries want to distract their populations as the oil prices collapse. Most of the reports were saying that there wasn't that the Azerbaijanis didn't take any territory, but a source that I sort of respect more than pretty much anyone else on this particular should be Simon Sarajian. He was at the Moscow Times. He's now at Harvard. He's actually from Karabakh. He was born there. And he said from the reports he's read that it looks like Azerbaijan. So they took actually a lot of territory and then were pushed back by the Armenian forces. Right. But they still hold on to three heights and about 200 to 300 square miles that they took from what had been the ceasefire line. So that's, I think, where we're at right now.
Right. Because generally, Armenia has had the better of the fighting, right? They've been fighting for almost 20 years now.
And, yeah.
Maybe more than 20 years.
Well, yeah, it really started in a low-level way in 88. It turned into a full-scale, armored units and even some air units and artillery and everything in 93, 94. Right. It went from irregulars to more regulars. And Armenia, won. The Karabakh Armenians won very handily.
When you say that it might be in part a distraction by an oil state, there's a really interesting parallel where the rich state has all the weapons and still doesn't do very well against the poor state, and that's Saudi Arabia and Yemen. Because just this week, or about 10 days ago, I think, in Midi, due south of Jizan on the coast, a few miles below the Saudi border, apparently a sizable force of Saudi troops and their Sunni Yemen allies were destroyed by the Houthi. And the Houthi have very little.
Yeah.
The U.S. Coast Guard and its – no, sorry, not the U.S. Coast Guard. The U.S. Navy in its brave way just intercepted a boat that was supposedly carrying Iranian equipment to the Houthi in Yemen, because they're Shia and Iran is supposedly helping them and is supposedly the puppeteer behind all this. And I read the description of the weapons on that ship, and it was basically – rifles, machine guns, RPGs, and a lot of bullets, and that's it. The Saudis are attacking people with weapons like that, with F-16s, and yet the Saudis have been doing very badly, and they're now offering the Houthi a ceasefire. So, strangely enough, the weaponry doesn't always win.
Yeah, yeah. If the will to fight is there. Yeah, so I saw that. I mean, and the obvious absurd hypocrisy that we, patting ourselves on the back for intercepting a shipment of guns to the Houthi while at the same time selling the Saudis the most expensive high-tech mass-killing airborne weapons, us and the British, right?
So, yeah. And I don't know why, but that seems to have led to either the Saudi defeat or something else has led to a real news blackout on this. Mm-hmm. There's very little about Yemen anymore, which was not always the case. For a while, the press found it interesting. I don't know. Maybe they thought the Saudis would win.
Yeah, no, it's true. It never really did make it to the front page as much. It's a good question. I mean, people maybe just believe, oh, well, the Houthi must be puppets of the Iranians. Therefore, they must be bad. They must be a nuisance. I don't know.
Like some yegg getting their orders from Shia Yegg Central.
Exactly.
That's roughly the mainstream idea.
And then a little bit north of there, a more cheerful story with the Qatari bird hunters.
Yeah, this is a hilarious story. Okay, I don't know if people remember this, but way back in December 2015, there was a brief story about a member of the Qatar royal family who was kidnapped by Shia militia in southern Iraq. And you may wonder, what was a Qatari royal doing in southern Iraq? Because, you know, I've only lived in northern Iraq and Kuwait, but this place is very near to Kuwait, and I know what the landscape is like, and it's like the ugliest place I've ever been. It's a sedimentary desert. You know, the silt of the Tigris and Euphrates have built up this land for a long time. Ur, ancient Ur, was roughly where the city of Nasiriyah is now, and that's far inland by now. So this is just hot, dry silt, as far as the eye can see. So what was he doing there? Well, this all goes back to a story I read a long time ago and which I recommend to everybody. It's by Jane Meyer, who we both like.
I think it's by Mary Ann. If it's Hunting with the Shakes, it's Mary Ann Weaver.
Oh shoot, sorry. Okay, yeah, it was Hunting with the Shakes. It came out in the New Yorker in 1992, and it's a really detailed account of the gigantic organized hunts that Gulf Shakes put on in Baluchistan in western Pakistan each year. And they're only after one animal, and that's the hubara, as they call it, a bustard, a kind of pheasant. And they spend millions of dollars each year and hire hundreds of people to catch a few of these little birds. The reason is apparently that they think it's an aphrodisiac. And it's also simply a custom. So they did this for decades with their newfound money until they pretty much wiped out the hubara in Pakistan. And the Pakistani parliament, which has been getting a little stroppy with Arabian Peninsula rulers lately, like the Pakistani parliament refused to send Pakistani mercenaries to help the Saudis against the Yemenis. And the Pakistani authorities also refused to give Qatari, another emirate, royals their usual hubara hunting permit. So they're not going to give up their hubara. These are, you know, kind of set in their ways, those people, those Gulf royals. So they found another place where there was still some hubara left, and that was southern Iraq. So December 2015, this Qatari prince and his entourage, which consisted of at least 28 people, are camping out a little northwest of the Kuwaiti border in southern Iraq. Everything's fine and happy, and maybe three dozen men on SUVs roll up with machine guns and say, "We gotcha." These are Shia militiamen, because somehow or other, don't ask me how, this Qatari prince failed to look at an ethnic map of Iraq and failed to notice that southern Iraq is mostly Shia. Now, if you look at an ethnic map of Iraq really carefully, there's an area just north of the Kuwaiti border where there's a little Sunni enclave, and he may have thought he was close enough to that to be safe. Well, he thought wrong. So he was kidnapped. All of the party, and remember there were at least 28 of them, got kidnapped. And were held all this time. And just yesterday, there was a story on the BBC that the Qatari royal has been released. And if you read the story carefully, there's a kind of grim Evelyn Waugh humor to it, because it says he and one of his Pakistani guides were released. That means there are at least 26 others still being held or already buried. Lord knows.
Possibly held for further shakedown payments, to assure that payments are being made, as if the sheikh would care.
Yeah, those are expendable people. Yeah. But still, I mean, it may be a point of pride. You never know. Mm-hmm. Royals are kind of cool when they're on your side, but if you become inconvenient for them, wherever they are and whenever they are, you don't exist anymore. But the interesting thing is, what kind of deal was made? I mean, you have to assume, first of all, that a lot of money changed hands. But there's also a political angle. I mean, this would have been settled by the Shia parties of southern Iraq, who basically rule the country now. And you have to wonder if they exacted some sort of political damages from the Qataris as well, because the Qataris have been the most active in fomenting sectarian war, like in Syria. They've been encouraging the Bahraini Sunni royal family to mess with their Shia minority. And they've certainly had an ambiguous stance about Iraq. They are certainly not happy that it's under Shia domination for the first time in centuries. And you have to wonder if part of the price for this prince was a promise to back off a little bit. And you also have to wonder where he was all this time. I mean, how do you treat a prince when you've got a captive prince? Is it going to matter if you treat him well or badly?
Is it going to be like Zed? You know, you bring Zed out of the box. I'm sure they'd want to.
I don't know what folks get up to.
That's an expensive turkey shoot.
That's exactly what it was. Yeah. They even look sort of like turkeys.
Yeah.
And anybody out there who's interested in screenplays, like, first of all, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for you. That's a that's a fatal affliction. But if you want a slightly better than usual chance, this is the comedy of all time. I mean,
it's I was just trying to think. I mean, Chris Farley somehow, I imagine, would be like this. He's dead now, of course, but, you know, he would have been perfect for it. One of those B movies. It would be a great B comedy movie,
absolutely, I think,
you know.
We need more good B movie people.
Like a later Richard Pryor, you know, when he was doing these kind of B movies. it's funny. It's inherently funny. So I think that'll be it for the show today. We've gone on pretty long, including Gunnar's great interview. So I just want to thank everyone. Thank all of our subscribers again. You guys are the best, and we keep growing, which is just still messing with my misanthropy.
That's mine too, and my self-loathing and all kinds of things.
Yes. We'll be back next week with more war, because war never ends. Thanks, John.
Okay, bye, Mark.
Bye.
Show the miles I put behind me, they continue to remind how fast I'm growing old. Guess I'll die with this fever in my soul. I wonder just what makes a man keep pushing on. What makes me keep on humming this old highway song?